Two brothers from Singapore had the world at their feet. They had taken over the family business and built it up to a successful empire. And encouraged by their success, they joined forces to start a new company together. On a business trip to Hong Kong, they both would be murdered and their bodies entombed in concrete. Nearly 40 years later, this double murder remains unsolved. Hi, I'm Lee, and welcome to True Crime Queen. I post solved and unsolved cases from around the world every week on YouTube and on your favourite podcast platforms. Before I go on, a warning. This is true crime. It's real life with real people, and these cases can be horrific and suitable for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised. Sources for this case are listed below if you wish to dive in further. Today's case takes place in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was originally part of the British colonies but was transferred to China in 1997. It has a rich history originating in farming and fishing, but is now known worldwide for its financial markets and home to about 90-odd billionaires. It has a distinctive landscape of mountains, buildings, and the beautiful Hong Kong harbour, dotted with junks. Over 7.5 million people live in Hong Kong in a space of just over 428 square miles, most in high-rise apartments densely packed. And although you can see more skyscrapers, over 8,000, than any other country, it still manages to maintain 40% of green space and parklands. The lucky number in Hong Kong is 8 because it represents wealth, but the number 4 is often omitted in Hong Kong because it sounds like death. So you might find that your hotel doesn't have a fourth floor because it's unlucky. In today's case, we're going to go to one of the many skyscrapers in Hong Kong, and although the apartment wasn't on the fourth floor, it was certainly tragic for George Chia, Sun Seng, and his brother Stephen. Buckle up and let's dive in. On the night of the 31st of March 1984, Mr. Lin was drying clothes on the balcony of his 26th-floor apartment at Elizabeth House, Gloucester Road, Causeway Bay, Hong Kong. The unpleasant smell that he and his wife noticed a few days earlier was still there, and they had both put the odour down to something the sea breeze was bringing in. But the smell seemed to linger and get worse. He pushed it to the back of his mind, though, and continued to hang out the washing. Then one of his freshly washed white towels fell on the balcony floor. Picking it up, he noticed it had a stain on it, and looking closer, he seen that the stain was red, like blood. There was nothing on his balcony that could have caused the stain, so he peered into the neighbour's balcony next door. There was no one home, and Mr. and Mrs. Lin had wondered why the apartment had been so silent lately. The unpleasant smell was far worse on the balcony next door, and it actually seemed to be coming from the balcony, not the sea air. And when he peered over the ledge to see the balcony, he noticed what looked like blood coming from the bottom of the built-in flower bed on the balcony. The police were called in to investigate. The police arrived at apartment A2 on the 26th floor of Elizabeth House. No one answered their knock on the door, so the building manager was contacted to open the door for them. And stepping out onto the balcony on the 26th floor, the police inspected the planter box that the neighbours had raised the alarm about. What appeared to be blood stained the balcony floor, and it seemed to have seeped out from the concrete planter box. The box was 2.5 metres or 8 feet long, 1 foot wide and 3 feet deep. And instead of being an open box allowing for soil and plants, it had been crudely cemented in, creating a high-rise tomb. And the box needed to be opened and it had to be done on site. It could not be moved. It was fixed onto the balcony. The next day, the police arrived with the tools to begin the slow and painstaking task of breaking open the planter box. careful not to cause too much damage and destroy any potential evidence. Residents of the building were asked to close their windows, and many elected to leave the building that day. The smell was getting worse. After 3 hours of hard work, the concrete planter box was opened, and the strong smell of decomposition filled the air. Firefighters took over from police to carry out the delicate task of removing more concrete. They slowly used saws and chisels and chipped away at the concrete to uncover what had been encased within it. Eventually, they found a dark brown or black airplane shirt. Underneath that, there was a sheet with bloodstains on it. And removing the sheet, the police discovered the bodies of two men. Each body had been wrapped in cloth, including their heads, to give the look of an Egyptian mummy. Their hands were tied behind their backs and their feet were chained. The bodies had been placed on top of each other, head to toe, toe to head. Underneath the bodies were magazines in English and Chinese, two beer cans, keys, a screwdriver and screws, a 5 kilo hammer and two pitchers. The pictures were of a former Miss Hong Kong winner who had gone on to be a well-known television celebrity. The police didn't believe the pictures of the woman were a lead and they were dismissed as not being significant. They could have come from any of the many magazines in the apartment. And although the tools looked like they could be promising for evidence, like the hammer and the screwdriver, they were ruled out as murder weapons. There was no evidence of injuries on the bodies that could have been caused by these tools. There were marks on their necks and, bizarrely, inside their mouths were four keys. The bodies had no identification on them, so the police now had to establish who the men were and who had ended their lives and disposed of them in their high-rise tomb. The police contacted the property manager for the apartment and they found it had been rented from the 20th of February, just 2 months earlier, to an Indonesian man named Abdul Karim, also known as Lim Boon Kai, and he appeared to be in his 30s. He spoke fluent Cantonese, had an Indonesian passport, and he'd rented the unit at 5,800 yuan a month. About a month later, two men that the property manager described as Asians paid a month's rent at their office for the apartment. They didn't leave a name, so the police were no closer to establishing their identity, and if it was indeed the two men that were in the concrete box. Prior to the bodies being discovered, the Royal Garden Hotel had notified the police about some unclaimed luggage left at the hotel. Two brothers had checked in on the 28th of February. They told staff on the 2nd of March that they would be back later to check out, but they never returned or collected their luggage or arranged for the luggage to be collected or stored. The two men were Singaporeans, George Chia Soon Seng, aged 27, and his brother Stephen, who was 32. The bodies in the flower box were tentatively identified as the two brothers, and once the post-mortem was carried out, fingerprints were taken so a comparison could be made. This was a difficult task. Due to the state of decomposition, the fingers were in a terrible condition, and they had to make the best of it with the prints that they could obtain. The prints were compared with those on file with the Singapore Ministry of Defence, and they keep records of all citizens over 18 who undergo 2.5 years of national service. Dental records were obtained from Singapore and they confirmed the identities as well, as George Chia Soon Seng and his brother Stephen. They were heirs to the Million Goldsmith and Jewellers Company. It's a chain of jewellers that was based in Singapore with 7 wholesale and export outlets. The company had been founded by their father, Chia Mu Hang, in 1953, and they manufactured jewellery until the late 80s. The business was good, but it wasn't until the two brothers took over that it expanded and became a leader in its field. They were known for using modern marketing, especially George, and really changing how business was done in the jewellery industry. Stephen was the eldest child and George the third son. George was described as a colourful and dynamic man. While still in school, he would help out at the stores, often doing his homework behind the counter. And when he was just 10, he was given the task of weighing gold in the workshop. He couldn't work in the front of the store because he just wasn't tall enough to reach the counter. And when it came time to go to university, rather than studying business and joining the family manufacturing company, he decided to study science. But before he finished his degree, he left and became the assistant manager at one of the chain stores in the family business. By the time he was 18 in 1974, he'd introduced new fancy marketing methods into the stores. Instead of haggling with customers over prices, as was the custom, he took out full-page newspaper ads instead. At the time, it was innovative and it really helped expand the family business into an empire. He introduced VIP customer service. If a customer didn't buy an item, it didn't matter. The store was there to offer great service and advice, which it did. And instead of spray and pray marketing, where you put something out there and hope for the best, he used feedback from customers to plan out strategies for sales, stock, and inventory purchases. And although this may seem obvious nowadays, this was new in the 1970s. After 7 years, when he was just 25, he was running the show, taking on both the management and marketing roles. And after a while, he moved into the biggest earner for the company and became the manager of the Rocher head office, as well as export and marketing manager for the business. He was self-educated, he read a lot of journals, and he started computerizing the systems. And he started to export jewelry to the South Pacific Islands and Africa in 1979. All of this success from someone so young and without any formal qualifications made him the envy of well-established jewelers, and many thought he was an upstart and looked down on him. Others thought of him as a leader among Singapore goldsmiths. George was also a master of the media. He'd readily give interviews whenever anyone asked and about anything. It didn't have to be about the business. Decisions on his personal life and spiritual matters, they were all worthy of a sit-down interview. He had the world at his feet, wealthy, successful, and all his business decisions literally turned to gold. And at some stage, he felt that this wealth was a burden, and while he didn't want to dispose of his wealth, he wanted to make peace with it and be someone that was known for more than his financial acumen. It was this in mind that he joined a Sri Lankan monastery for a two-week retreat, and he studied Buddhism and learned meditation. And although he returned to the family business, he became fascinated with Buddhism for the rest of his life. Stephen was the eldest son. He was quieter. He wasn't flamboyant like his younger brother. He had been married for just a year to the daughter of a Burmese millionaire. And like his brother, he also worked in the family business as a manager of Creta Air Store. George and Stephen often travelled together for work, going to trade shows and doing all they could to expand the family business. From November 1983 to February 1984, they visited Hong Kong 3 times, and each time they stayed at the Royal Garden Hotel. They both had travelled to Hong Kong on the 28th of February, but it seems that George left first and Stephen arrived later. They checked into their double room at the hotel, which they'd booked for the 28th of February. Some witnesses say a female and 2 businessmen joined them on their trip as well. The main purpose of their trip was to visit jewellers, show off their wares and their export stock, and they made their way around 10 to 15 Hong Kong jewellers doing just that. George also had some other business to attend to. Before they left Singapore, George received a phone call from a man he hadn't met, and he wanted to meet to discuss business at the Apollo Hotel in Singapore. George turned up to the meeting with friends, but the man never arrived. He did contact him afterwards, and there was back and forth on the phone, but he's never been identified, and there are no notes of what this business meeting could be about. It might be connected to the case, but it might not. George and Stephen, as well as running the family business, also had their own side gig trading in gold futures. And in early 1982, they formed the Fu Lu Financial Company to operate their speculation in gold business. At some point, there was a dispute about one of these deals, with $6 million at issue, and George wanted to sort this matter out while in Hong Kong. The police went door to door questioning the occupants of apartments from the 20th to the 28th floor of the building, and it seemed amazing that two people could be murdered, their bodies encased in cement on a balcony where neighbours could see into, and no one had reported anything suspicious. Residents were asked if they'd seen anything or anyone unusual, maybe someone doing renovations or using cement in their homes. They did find some witnesses with information. One noticed an unknown man entering the building. Someone else remembered George Chia coming into the building with two men and a woman on 28th of February. Maybe it was the same man and woman he was seen with at the hotel. But no one knows. They found a number of neighbours had heard some loud noises coming from apartment A2. At least one man and a woman late on the 18th or early morning of the 19th of March. The woman had said in Cantonese, "Don't do that, don't do that," and other residents remembered men crying out for help in Cantonese, and they heard that on March the 18th. All of the witness statements pointed to activities mid-March that were unusual, but no one called the police or complained to the building manager. One witness remembered a beautiful, well-dressed woman, maybe Indonesian, who was seen with a man getting out of a taxi and entering the building. Another remembered the couple getting into the lift. What made them memorable was that they were both carrying a bag of cement each. A search of the apartment for forensic evidence, unknown blood, fingerprints, murder weapons, it all came up empty-handed. Whoever the killers were, they had been meticulous about removing any trace of them from the apartment. They did find an audio tape, or a cassette as it was referred to in the 80s, a notebook where the brothers recorded their gold trading, and five business cards. Under the sink, they found buckets filled with mud, no doubt the soil that was removed from the planter box, and leftover cement. Interpol was alerted to be on the lookout for Abdul Karim, aka Lim Bun Kai, in April, as well as the names on the five business cards in the apartment. They were all from Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. Post-mortem was carried out, and it estimated that the brothers had both died at the same time, around 10 days earlier. And the last time they were seen was on the 28th of February. The suspicious activities in the apartment complex all centred around mid-March, and the bodies were found at the end of March. Where were the brothers between the end of February and the middle of March, when it's suspected that they were murdered? There was clearly more to these double murders than met the eye. The first lead the police needed to investigate came from the media. The Chinese press reported that members of the Chia family had been kidnapped, and the family received a number of threatening phone calls. A parcel was left at their home containing a cassette tape, ransom demand ranging from 420,000 to 1 million Hong Kong dollars, and the Chia family eventually paid about 1 million or Hong Kong 3.73 million, depending on the source. More disturbingly, in the parcel there were photographs. Some were of the Chia family. One source said that a photograph of a severed arm had been given to the family in the parcel, and this was more a threat rather than a promise, because the Hong Kong police advised that the bodies did not have any limbs removed. The police moved their investigation to Singapore to investigate whether this was a kidnapping and murder. The family hadn't told the Hong Kong police when the threats were made or sought any assistance from the Singapore police, and they initially denied the kidnapping altogether. Family members eventually revealed that they paid the ransom in mid-March, and there hasn't been any information released publicly if the family were given any evidence that the brothers were alive at this time, and if so, how and when they would be released. After handing over the ransom, Mr. Chia went to temple to pray for his son's return. But days turned into weeks and there was still no sign of his sons. The ransom had been given to a Singaporean man who acted as a middleman between the family and the kidnappers. And the police had high hopes that this man would be the key to finding and locating the kidnappers and potential murderers. He was named as a person of interest, but he still has not been found. By mid-April, the police had collected the kidnapping evidence from Singapore, including the audio tape ransom demand, financial records and statements which recorded the family's travels and activities. Speech analysis were called in to analyse the audio tape, and they were confident that this would reveal the nationality of the kidnapper and that would help them close the case. Some sources claim that this tape contains audio of the brothers begging their family to pay the ransom. But sadly, the speech analyst came up empty-handed as well. The police believe that the brothers were probably asked to the apartment to have a drink. There'd been a can of Carlton beer which had been drugged found in the apartment. And after they'd drank enough to make them woozy, it's believed that ropes were put around their neck and as they struggled, they were killed. And this would explain the marks around the necks, but not the motive. Over the years, there have been a number of theories on why the brothers were killed, but to date, there have been no arrests made and any of the persons of interest referred to have not been located. Most of the theories revolve around the company that the brothers operated together, trading in gold futures, and the dispute that George wanted to handle while in Hong Kong. The brothers were allegedly one of the main customers of an Indonesian company called Hock Luck Gold and Commodity Futures Trading Company. It's no longer operating, but during this time it was run by Mr. Liu, and he had a reputation as a bit of a fixer. There's nothing though in the evidence to suggest that the brothers needed the services of a fixer, and he was said to have introduced some of his friends to the brothers, but there doesn't seem to be anything in the financial statements that the police obtained that would indicate that his services were engaged. But the police, like so many people in this case, were unable to locate Mr. Liu. There's no clear-cut facts on the dispute about the gold either. Some say the brothers had been scammed by an Indonesian man and they were owed money and George was going to sort it out. In mid-April, the police felt that they were close to an arrest, but nothing came of it. Other reports say that the Indonesian company was owed money by the brothers. A gang of hired Indonesian debt collectors were in the area at the time, and this gives some credence to the theory. In any event, there seems to be a lot of uncertainty and disputes, and it's not known if Mr. Liu was the Indonesian man referred to. It's also said that the Chia brothers brought some jewellery with them, which seems obvious as they were showcasing their family business and their export jewellery. But the jewellery wasn't found with them or in their luggage, so the police haven't ruled out that it might just be a business scam in order to steal the jewellery. The most common theory was that they were kidnapped purely for financial reasons, based on the success of the family business, and somehow the kidnapping went wrong and the brothers died. The police believe money was an aspect of the crime, but it wasn't the only motive. One source sets out the circumstances of the kidnapping a little different, in that George was the target, not both brothers. They say that George was kidnapped soon after he arrived in Hong Kong alone on February the 28th, 1984. The kidnappers then sent threatening letters and tapes to the Chia home with a million Singapore dollar ransom demand. And it's claimed that Mr. Chia Sr. then sent his elder son Stephen to Hong Kong with 500,000 Singapore dollars. The kidnappers, angry with not receiving the full amount, killed both brothers. The Chia family has denied this version of events. I have wondered if the Singaporean man that acted as the go-between between the kidnappers and the Chia family ever passed the ransom money on to the kidnappers. Maybe he didn't, and thinking that the ransom hadn't been paid, they killed the brothers. It seems that the kidnappers and murderers were very professional. They were able to isolate the brothers for a period of time, arrange for a middleman, murder the men in a building packed with residents, none of which raised an alarm, dispose of their bodies, clean the apartment, cover their tracks, and disappear. And disappear for nearly 40 years. It seems unbelievable that they have managed to evade the police for this long. To my knowledge, there was never a reward offered for information, and to date, the case remains unsolved. After the brothers died, the jewellery business declined without them at the helm, and it ultimately closed. George, being a single man when he died and enamoured with Buddhism, had ensured that his memory would live on. He'd finally found a way to deal with the burden of wealth that he felt. He wanted to educate others on Buddhism, and his first idea was to distribute comic books to educate and spread the word. This idea came apart, though, when he couldn't find an illustrator, so he decided instead on a public library devoted solely to Buddhism. And the year before he died, he set up a 5,000-volume library in Tanjong Katong Shopping Centre. In his will, he provided for the library, ensuring that there would be money for staff and books to continue the library after his death. And the library lives on as a memorial for him and a source of education for anyone interested in learning more about Buddhism. As Hong Kong is known for its financial savvy and huge property market, I thought I'd add a few asides relating to the impact of the murders on others associated with the apartment block. The deaths brought attention to the apartment building, and the building owner actually had action taken against him. It was claimed he was using the building for residential purposes. It's unclear if this related to the whole building or just the unit where the brothers were found. In any event, he was ordered to demolish unauthorised works and restore the building to the approved plans. A fine of Hong Kong $200,000 would apply if he failed to do so. The murders affected the value of all the apartments in the building, and even decades later, the apartments, and particularly A2 where the brothers were found, all sell for a lot less than comparable apartments. Professor Chow Kwong Wing of Hong Kong University's Department of Real Estate and Construction conducted a study on how murder affects the property market of units, and he found that in Chinese society, a murder is believed to have a bad influence on the feng shui of the property and decreases its market value, and in this case, by nearly 7%. His study found that the more brutal the murder, the more restless the soul of the dead. The ghosts will come back to visit the place they used to live, and it will disturb and bring bad luck to the new occupants. And some people believe that the spirits of the murdered will disturb their neighbours as well. In Hong Kong, estate agents and landlords are obliged to tell prospective buyers and tenants about untimely deaths, including murder and suicide. I can't imagine the horrendous ordeal that the Chia family and all the loved ones of George and Stephen have gone through. Not only were George and Stephen kidnapped, but murdered, and their cases remain unsolved for so long. My heart goes out to all those who loved and cared for George and Stephen, and I hope one day soon that this case will be solved. If you found this case interesting, please consider taking a moment to leave a review. It really helps me out. If you would like to hear more true crime cases from me, consider subscribing to the podcast. Until next time, be kind to each other and stay safe out there.